group is instructed to hide their emotions. I'm going to show you another film clip, and I want you to hide your emotional reactions. How to do so most effectively? Gross distinguishes between antecedent and response-focused strategies. Response-focused is dragging the emotional horse back to the barn after it's fled. You're watching the next horrific footage, feeling queasy, and you think, okay, sit still, breathe slowly. Typically, this causes even greater activation of the amygdala and sympathetic nervous system. Antecedent strategies generally work better as they keep the barn door closed from the start. These are about thinking slash feeling about something else, e.g. that great vacation, or thinking slash feeling differently about what you're seeing. Reappraisals such as, that isn't real, those are just actors. And when done right, the PFC, particularly the DLPFC, activates. The amygdala and sympathetic nervous system are damped and subjective distress decreases. Footnote. Given the circuitry of the PFC, the most probable sequence is activation of the DLPFC, then activation of the VMPFC, then inhibition of the amygdala. Antecedent reappraisal is why placebos work. Thinking, my finger is about to be pricked by a pin, activates the amygdala along with a circuit of pain-responsive brain regions, and the pin hurts. Be told beforehand that the hand cream being slathered on your finger is a powerful analgesic cream, and you think, my finger is about to be pricked by a pin, but this cream will block the pain. The PFC activates, blunting activity in the amygdala and pain circuitry, as well as pain perception. Thought processes like these, writ large, are the core of a particularly effective type of psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, for the treatment of disorders of emotion regulation. Consider someone with a social anxiety disorder caused by a horrible early experience with trauma. To simplify, CBT is about providing the tools to reappraise circumstances that evoke the anxiety. Remember that in this social situation, those awful feelings you're having are about what happened back then, not what is happening now. Footnote. And this extends to a meta-level of reappraisal. As Gross has shown, that one mediator of treatment outcome when using CBT for social anxiety is the belief that one can effectively reappraise. Controlling emotional responses with thought like this is very top-down. The frontal cortex calms the overwrought amygdala. But the PFC-limbic relationship can be bottom-up as well, when a decision involves a gut feeling. This is the backbone of Damasio's somatic marker hypothesis. Choosing among options can involve a cerebral cost-benefit analysis. But it also involves somatic markers, internal simulations of what each outcome would feel like, run in the limbic system and reported to the VMPFC. The process is not a thought experiment. It's an emotion experiment. In effect, an emotional memory of a possible future. A mild somatic marker activates only the limbic system. Should I do behavior A? Maybe not. The possibility of outcome B feels scary. A more vivid somatic marker activates the sympathetic nervous system as well. Should I do behavior A? Definitely not. I can feel my skin getting clammy at the possibility of outcome B. Experimentally boosting the strength of that sympathetic signal strengthens the aversion. This is a picture of normal collaboration between the limbic system and frontal cortex. Naturally, things are not always balanced. Anger, for example, makes people less analytical and more reflexive in decisions about punishment. Stressed people often make hideously bad decisions, marinated in emotion. Chapter 4 examines what stress does to the amygdala and frontal cortex. Footnote. And then there are circumstances where the limbic system overwhelms the frontal cortex, where there is no such thing as a good decision, where each choice is worse than the other. Think about what is, for a parent, probably the most excruciating scene in all of cinema. In Sophie's Choice. When Sophie must make the choice, when, Without warning, she has seconds to choose which of her two children lives, which dies. Making her bludgeoned, unimaginable choice requires her frontocortical neurons to send signals to her prefrontal cortex and on to her motor cortex. After all, she eventually says words and moves her hands, pushing one child forward. And the bidirectionality of the circuitry is shown by the fact that her limbic system, no doubt, was screaming in agony to the frontal cortex. The effects of stress on the frontal cortex are dissected by the late Harvard psychologist Daniel Wegener in an aptly titled paper, How to Think, Say, or Do Precisely the Worst Thing on Any Occasion. He considers what Edgar Allan Poe called the imp of the perverse. We see a rut coming up in the road ahead and proceed to steer our bike right into it. We make a mental note not to mention a sore point in conversation and then cringe in horror as we blurt out exactly that thing. We carefully cradle the glass of red wine as we cross the room, all the while thinking, don't spill, and then juggle it onto the carpet under the gaze of our host. Wegener demonstrated a two-step process of frontocortical regulation. A. One stream identifies X as being very important. B. The other stream tracks whether the conclusion is do X or never do X. And during stress, distraction, or heavy cognitive load, the two streams can dissociate. The A stream exerts its presence without the B stream saying which fork in the road to take. The chance that you will do precisely the wrong thing rises not despite your best efforts, but because of a stress-boggled version of them. This concludes our overview of the frontal cortex. The mantra is that it makes you do the harder thing when that is the right thing. Five final points. Doing the harder thing effectively is not an argument for valuing either emotion or cognition more than the other. For example, as discussed in Chapter 11, we are our most pro-social concerning in-group morality when our rapid, implicit emotions and intuitions dominate, but our most pro-social concerning out-group morality when cognition holds sway. It's easy to conclude that the PFC is about preventing imprudent behaviors. Don't do it, you'll regret it. But that isn't always the case. For example, in Chapter 17, we'll consider the surprising amount of frontocortical effort it can take to pull a trigger. Like everything about the brain, the structure and function of the frontal cortex vary enormously among individuals. For example, resting metabolic rate in the PFC varies approximately 30-fold among people. Footnote. Consider individuals with repressive personalities. Such individuals have highly regimented affect and behavior. They're not emotionally expressive and aren't great at reading emotions in others. They like ordered, structured, predictable lives, can tell you what they're having for dinner a week from Thursday, and complete everything on time. And they have elevated metabolism in the frontal cortex and elevated circulating levels of stress hormones, showing that it can be enormously stressful to construct a world in which nothing stressful ever occurs. What causes such individual differences? See the rest of this book. Doing the harder thing when it's the right thing to do. Right, in this case, is used in a neurobiological and instrumental sense rather than a moral one. Consider lying. Obviously, the frontal cortex aids the hard job of resisting the temptation. But it is also a major frontocortical task, particularly a DLPFC task, to lie competently, to control the emotional content of a signal, to generate an abstract distance between message and meaning. Interestingly, pathological liars have atypically large amounts of white matter in the PFC, indicating more complex wiring. But again, the right thing in the setting of the frontal cortically assisted lying is amoral. An actor lies to an audience about having the feelings of a morose Danish prince. A situationally ethical child lies, telling grandma how excited she is about her present, concealing the fact that she already has that toy. A leader tells bold-faced lies, starting a war. A financier with Ponzi in his blood defrauds investors. A peasant woman lies to a uniformed thug, telling him she does not know the whereabouts of the refugees she knows are hiding in her attic. As with much about the frontal cortex, it's context, context, context. Where does the frontal cortex get the metaphorical motivation to do the harder thing? For this, we now look at our final branch, the dopaminergic reward system in the brain. The mesolimbic mesocortical dopamine system. Reward, pleasure, and happiness are complex, and the motivated pursuit of them occurs in at least a rudimentary form in many species. The neurotransmitter dopamine is central to understanding this. Nuclei, inputs, and outputs. Dopamine is synthesized in multiple brain regions. One such region helps initiate movement. Damage there produces Parkinson's disease. Another regulates the release of a pituitary hormone. But the dopaminergic system that concerns us arises from an ancient, evolutionarily conserved region near the brainstem called the ventral tegmental area. Henceforth, the tegmentum. A key target of these dopaminergic neurons is the last multisyllabic brain region to be introduced in this chapter, the nucleus accumbens, henceforth the accumbens. There's debate as to whether the accumbens should count as part of the limbic system, but at the least, it's highly limbic-ish. Here's our first pass at the organization of this circuitry. A. The tegmentum sends projections to the accumbens and other limbic areas such as the amygdala and hippocampus. This is collectively called the mesolimbic dopamine pathway. B. The tegmentum also projects to the PFC, but significantly not other cortical areas. This is called the mesocortical dopamine pathway. I'll be lumping the mesolimbic plus mesocortical pathways together as the dopaminergic system, ignoring they're not always being activated simultaneously. C. The accumbens projects to regions associated with movement. D. Naturally, most areas getting projections from the tegmentum and or accumbens project back to them. Most interesting will be the projections from the amygdala and PFC. Reward. As a first pass, the dopaminergic system is about reward. Various pleasurable stimuli activate tegmental neurons, triggering their release of dopamine. Some supporting evidence. A. Drugs like cocaine, heroin, and alcohol release dopamine in the accumbens. B. If tegmental release of dopamine is blocked, previously rewarding stimuli become aversive. C. Chronic stress or pain depletes dopamine and decreases the sensitivity of dopamine neurons to stimulation, producing the defining symptom of depression, anhedonia, the inability to feel pleasure. Some rewards, such as sex, release dopamine in every species examined. For humans, just thinking about sex suffices. Food evokes dopamine release in hungry individuals of all species, with an added twist in humans. Show a picture of a milkshake to someone after they've consumed one, and there's rarely dopaminergic activation. There's satiation. But with subjects who have been dieting, there's further activation. If you're working to restrict your food intake, a milkshake just makes you want another one. The mesolimbic dopamine system also responds to pleasurable aesthetics. In one study, people listened to new music. The more accumbens activation, the more likely subjects were to buy the music afterward. And then there is dopaminergic activation for artificial cultural inventions, for example, when typical males look at pictures of sports cars. Patterns of dopamine release are most interesting when concerning social interactions. Some findings are downright heartwarming. In one study, a subject would play an economic game with someone, where a player is rewarded under two circumstances. A. If both players cooperate, each receives a moderate reward, and B, stabbing the other person in the back gets the subject a big reward while the other person gets nothing. While both outcomes increase dopaminergic activity, the bigger increase occurred after cooperation. Footnote. As an important point, study subjects were all female. Other research examined the economic behavior of punishing jerks. In one study, subjects played a game where player B could screw over player A for a profit. Depending on the round, player A could either A, do nothing, B, punish player B by having some of player B's money taken at no cost to player A, or C, pay one unit of money to have two units taken from player B. Punishment activated the dopamine system, especially when subjects had to pay to punish. The greater the dopamine increase during no-cost punishment, the more willing someone was to pay to punish. Punishing norm violations is satisfying. Another great study, carried out by Elizabeth Phelps of New York University, concerns overbidding in auctions, where people bid more money than anticipated. This is interpreted as reflecting the additional reward of besting someone in the competitive aspect of bidding. Thus, winning an auction is intrinsically socially competitive, unlike winning a lottery. Winning a lottery and winning a bid both activated dopaminergic signaling in subjects. Losing a lottery had no effect, while losing a bidding war inhibited dopamine release. Not winning the lottery is bad luck. Not winning an auction is social subordination. This raises the specter of envy. In one neuroimaging study, subjects read about a hypothetical person's academic record, popularity, attractiveness, and wealth. Descriptions that evoked self-reported envy activated cortical regions involved in pain perception. Then the hypothetical individual was described as experiencing a misfortune, e.g., they were demoted. More activation of pain pathways at the news of the person's good fortune predicted more dopaminergic activation after learning of their misfortune. Thus, there's dopaminergic activation during Schadenfreude, gloating over an envied person's fall from grace. The dopamine system gives insights into jealousy, resentment, and invidiousness, leading to another depressing finding. A monkey has learned that when he presses a lever 10 times, he gets a raisin as a reward. That's just happened, and as a result, 10 units of dopamine are released in the accumbens. Now, surprise! The monkey presses the lever 10 times and gets 2 raisins. Whoa! 20 units of dopamine are released. And as the monkey continues to get paychecks of 2 raisins, the size of the dopamine response returns to 10 units. Now reward the monkey with only a single raisin, and dopamine levels decline. Why? This is our world of habituation, where nothing is ever as good as that first time. Unfortunately, things have to work this way because of our range of rewards. After all, reward coding must accommodate the rewarding properties of both solving a math problem and having an orgasm. Dopaminergic responses to reward, rather than being absolute, are relative to the reward value of alternative outcomes. In order to accommodate the pleasures of both mathematics and orgasms, the system must constantly rescale to accommodate the range of intensity offered by particular stimuli. The response to any reward must habituate with repetition, so that the system can respond over its full range to the next new thing. This was shown in a beautiful study by Wolfram Schultz of Cambridge University. Depending on the circumstance, monkeys were trained to expect either 2 or 20 units of reward. If they unexpectedly got either 4 or 40 units, respectively, there'd be an identical burst of dopamine release, giving 1 or 10 units produced an identical decrease. It was the relative, not absolute, size of the surprise that mattered over a tenfold range of reward. These studies show that the dopamine system is bidirectional. It responds with scale-free increases for unexpected good news and decreases for bad. Schultz demonstrated that following a reward, the dopamine system codes for discrepancy from expectation. Get what you expected, and there's a steady-state dribble of dopamine. Get more reward and/or get it sooner than expected, and there's a big burst. Less and/or later, a decrease. Some tegmental neurons respond to positive discrepancy from expectation, others to negative. Appropriately, the latter are local neurons that release the inhibitory neurotransmitter GABA. Those same neurons participate in habituation, where the reward that once elicited a big dopamine response becomes less exciting. Logically, these different types of coding neurons in the tegmentum, as well as the accumbens, get projections from the frontal cortex. That's where all the expectancy/discrepancy calculations take place. Okay, I thought I was going to get 5.0, but got 4.9. How big of a bummer is that? Additional cortical regions weigh in. In one study, subjects were shown an item to purchase, with the degree of accumbens activation predicting how much a person would pay. Then they were told the price. If it was less than what they were willing to spend, there was activation of the emotional VMPFC. More expensive, and there'd be activation of that disgust-related insular cortex. Combine all the neuroimaging data, and you could predict whether the person would buy the item. Thus, in typical mammals, the dopamine system codes in a scale-free manner over a wide range of experience for both good and bad surprises, and is constantly habituating to yesterday's news. But humans have something in addition, namely that we invent pleasures far more intense than anything offered by the natural world. Once, during a concert of cathedral organ music, as I sat getting goose flesh amid that tsunami of sound, I was struck with a thought. For a medieval peasant, this must have been the loudest human-made sound they ever experienced, awe-inspiring in now unimaginable ways. No wonder they signed up for the religion being proffered. And now, we are constantly pummeled with sounds that dwarf quaint organs. Once, hunter-gatherers might chance upon honey from a beehive and thus briefly satisfy a hard-wired food craving. And now, we have hundreds of carefully designed commercial foods that supply a burst of sensation unmatched by some lowly natural food. Once, we had lives that, amid considerable privation, also offered numerous subtle, hard-won pleasures. And now, we have drugs that cause spasms of pleasure and dopamine release 1,000-fold higher than anything stimulated in our old drug-free world. An emptiness comes from this combination of over-the-top non-natural sources of reward and the inevitability of habituation. This is because unnaturally strong explosions of synthetic experience and sensation and pleasure evoke unnaturally strong degrees of habituation. This has two consequences. First, soon we barely notice the fleeting whispers of pleasure caused by leaves in autumn, or by the lingering glance of the right person, or by the promise of reward following a difficult, worthy task. And the other consequence is that we eventually habituate to even those artificial deluges of intensity. If we were designed by engineers, as we consumed more, we'd desire less. But our frequent human tragedy is that the more we consume, the hungrier we get. More and faster and stronger. What was an unexpected pleasure yesterday is what we feel entitled to today, and what won't be enough tomorrow. The anticipation of reward. Thus, dopamine is about invidious, rapidly habituating reward. But dopamine is more interesting than that. Back to our well-trained monkey working for a reward. A light comes on in his room, signaling the start of a reward trial. He goes over to the lever, presses 10 times, and gets the raisin reward. This has happened often enough that there's only a small increase in dopamine with each raisin. However, importantly, lots of dopamine is released when the light first comes on, signaling the start of the reward trial, before the monkey starts lever pressing. In other words, once reward contingencies are learned, dopamine is less about reward than about its anticipation. Similarly, work by my Stanford colleague Brian Knudsen has shown dopamine pathway activation in people in anticipation of a monetary reward. Dopamine is about mastery and expectation and confidence. It's, I know how things work. This is going to be great. In other words, the pleasure is in the anticipation of reward, and the reward itself is nearly an afterthought, unless, of course, the reward fails to arrive, in which case it's the most important thing in the world. If you know your appetite will be sated, pleasure is more about the appetite than about the sating. This is hugely important. Anticipation requires learning. Learn Warren G. Harding's middle name, and synapses in the hippocampus become more excitable. Learn that when the light comes on, it's reward time, and it's hippocampal amygdaloid and frontal cortical neurons projecting to dopamine neurons that become more excitable. This explains context-dependent craving in addiction. Suppose an alcoholic has been clean and sober for years. Return him to where the alcohol consumption used to occur, e.g. that rundown street corner, that fancy men's club, and those potentiated synapses, those cues that were learned to be associated with alcohol, come roaring back into action. Dopamine surges with anticipation, and the craving inundates. Can a reliable cue of an impending reward eventually become rewarding itself? This has been shown by Huda Akil of the University of Michigan. A light in the left side of a rat's cage signals that lever pressing will produce a reward from a food chute on the right side. Remarkably, rats eventually will work for the chance to hang around on the left side of the cage just because it feels so nice to be there. The signal has gained the dopaminergic power of what is being signaled. Similarly, rats will work to be exposed to a cue that signals that some kind of reward is likely, without knowing what or when. This is what fetishes are, in both the anthropological and sexual sense. Schultz's group has shown that the magnitude of an anticipatory dopamine rise reflects two variables. First is the size of the anticipated reward. A monkey has learned that a light means that 10 lever presses earns 1 unit of reward, while a tone means 10 presses earns 10 units. And soon, a tone provokes more anticipatory dopamine than does a light. It's, "This is going to be great," versus, "This is going to be great." The second variable is extraordinary. The rule is that the light comes on, you press the lever, you get the reward. Now things change. Light comes on, press the lever, get the reward, only 50% of the time. Remarkably, once that new scenario is learned, far more dopamine is released. Why? Because nothing fuels dopamine release like the maybe of intermittent reinforcement. This additional dopamine is released at a distinctive time. The light comes on in the 50% scenario, producing the usual anticipatory dopamine rise before the lever pressing starts. Back in the predictable days, when lever pressing always earned a reward, once the pressing was finished, dopamine levels remained low until the reward arrived, followed by a little dopamine blip. But in this 50% scenario, once the pressing is finished, dopamine levels start rising, driven by the uncertainty of maybe yes, maybe no. Modify things further. Reward now occurs 25 or 75% of the time. A shift from 50 to 25% and a shift from 50 to 75% are exactly opposite in terms of the likelihood of reward, and work from Knudsen's group shows that the greater the probability of reward, the more activation in the medial PFC. But switches from 50 to 25% and from 50 to 75% both reduce the magnitude of uncertainty. And the secondary rise of dopamine for a 25 or 75% likelihood of reward is smaller than for 50%. Thus, anticipatory dopamine release peaks with the greatest uncertainty as to whether a reward will occur. Interestingly, in circumstances of uncertainty, enhanced anticipatory dopamine release is mostly in the mesocortical rather than the mesolimbic pathway, implying that uncertainty is a more cognitively complex state than is anticipation of predictable reward. None of this is news to the honorary psychologists running Las Vegas. Logically, gambling shouldn't evoke much anticipatory dopamine given the astronomical odds against winning. But the behavioral engineering, the 24/7 activity and lack of time cues, the cheap alcohol, pickling frontocortical judgment, the manipulations to make you feel like today is your lucky day, distorts and shifts the perception of the odds into a range where dopamine pours out and, oh, why not? Let's try again. The interaction between maybe and the propensity for addictive gambling is seen in a study of near misses, when 2 out of 3 reels line up in a slot machine. In control subjects, there was minimal dopaminergic activation after misses of any sort. Among pathological gamblers, a near miss activated the dopamine system like crazy. Another study concerned 2 betting situations with identical probabilities of reward, but different levels of information about reward contingencies. The circumstance with less information, i.e., that was more about ambiguity than risk, activated the amygdala and silenced dopaminergic signaling. What is perceived to be well-calibrated risk is addictive, while ambiguity is just agitating. Pursuit. So dopamine is more about anticipation of reward than about reward itself. Time for one more piece of the picture. Consider that monkey trained to respond to the light cue with lever pressing, and out comes the reward. As we now know, once that relationship is established, most dopamine release is anticipatory, occurring right after the cue. What happens if the post-light cue release of dopamine doesn't occur? Crucially, the monkey doesn't press the lever. Similarly, if you destroy its accumbens, a rat makes impulsive choices instead of holding out for a delayed larger reward. Conversely, back to the monkey, if instead of flashing the light cue, you electrically stimulate the tegmentum to release dopamine, the monkey presses the lever. Dopamine is not just about reward anticipation. It fuels the goal-directed behavior needed to gain that reward. Dopamine binds the value of a reward to the resulting work. It's about the motivation arising from those dopaminergic projections to the PFC that is needed to do the harder thing, i.e., to work. In other words, dopamine is not about the happiness of reward. It's about the happiness of pursuit of reward that has a decent chance of occurring. This is central to understanding the nature of motivation as well as its failures, e.g. during depression, where there is inhibition of dopamine signaling thanks to stress, or in anxiety, where such inhibition is caused by projections from the amygdala. It also tells us about the source of the frontocortical power behind willpower. In a task where one chooses between an immediate and a larger, delayed reward, contemplating the immediate reward activates limbic targets of dopamine, i.e. the mesolimbic pathway, whereas contemplating the delayed reward activates frontocortical targets, i.e. the mesocortical pathway. The greater the activation of the latter, the more likely there'll be gratification postponement. These studies involved scenarios of a short burst of work soon followed by reward. What about when the work required is prolonged and reward is substantially delayed? In that scenario, there is a secondary rise of dopamine, a gradual increase that fuels the sustained work. The extent of the dopamine ramp-up is a function of the length of the delay and the anticipated size of the reward. This reveals how dopamine fuels delayed gratification. If waiting X amount of time for a reward has value Z, waiting 2X should logically have value 1/2 Z. Instead, we temporally discount. The value is smaller, e.g., 1/4 Z. We don't like waiting. Dopamine and the frontal cortex are in the thick of this phenomenon. Discounting curves, a value of 1/4 Z instead of 1/2 Z, are coded in the accumbens, while DLPFC and VMPFC neurons code for time delay. This generates some complex interactions. For example, activate the VMPFC or inactivate the DLPFC, and short-term reward becomes more alluring. And a cool neuroimaging study of Knudsen's gives insight into impatient people with steep temporal discounting curves. Their accumbens, in effect, underestimates the magnitude of the delayed reward, and their DLPFC overestimates the length of the delay. Collectively, these studies show that our dopaminergic system, frontal cortex, amygdala, insula, and other members of the corpus code for differing aspects of reward magnitude, delay, and probability with varying degrees of accuracy, all influencing whether we manage to do the harder, more correct thing. Individual differences among people in the capacity for gratification postponement arise from variation in the volume of these individual neural voices. For example, there are abnormalities in dopamine response profiles during temporal discounting tasks in people with a maladaptive impulsiveness of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Similarly, addictive drugs bias the dopamine system toward impulsiveness. Phew! One more complication. These studies of temporal discounting typically involve delays on the order of seconds. Though the dopamine system is similar across numerous species, humans do something utterly novel. We delay gratification for insanely long times. No warthog restricts calories to look good in a bathing suit next summer. No gerbil works hard at school to get good SAT scores, to get into a good college, to get into a good grad school, to get a good job, to get into a good nursing home. We do something even beyond this unprecedented gratification delay. We use the dopaminergic power of the happiness of pursuit to motivate us to work for rewards that come after we are dead. Depending on your culture, this can be knowing that your nation is closer to winning a war because you've sacrificed yourself in battle, that your kids will inherit money because of your financial sacrifices, or that you will spend eternity in paradise. It is extraordinary neural circuitry that bucks temporal discounting enough to allow some of us to care about the temperature of the planet that our great-grandchildren will inherit. Basically, it's unknown how we humans do this. We may merely be a type of animal, mammal, primate, and ape, but we're a profoundly unique one. A final small topic, serotonin. This lengthy section has concerned dopamine, but an additional neurotransmitter, serotonin, plays a clear role in some behaviors that concern us. Starting with a 1979 study, low levels of serotonin in the brain were shown to be associated with elevated levels of human aggression, with endpoints ranging from psychological measures of hostility to overt violence. A similar serotonin-aggression relationship was observed in other mammals and, remarkably, even crickets, mollusks, and crustaceans. As work continued, an important qualifier emerged. Low serotonin didn't predict premeditated, instrumental violence. It predicted impulsive aggression, as well as cognitive impulsivity, e.g., steep temporal discounting or trouble inhibiting a habitual response. Other studies linked low serotonin to impulsive suicide, independent of severity of the associated psychiatric illness. Moreover, in both animals and humans, pharmacologically decreasing serotonin signaling increases behavioral and cognitive impulsivity, e.g., impulsively torpedoing a stable, cooperative relationship with a player in an economic game. Importantly, while increasing serotonin signaling did not lessen impulsiveness in normal subjects, it did in subjects prone toward impulsivity, such as adolescents with conduct disorder. How does serotonin do this? Nearly all serotonin is synthesized in one brain region, which projects to the usual suspects, the tegmentum, accumbens, PFC, and amygdala, where serotonin enhances dopamine's effects on goal-directed behavior. This is as dependable a finding as you get in this business. Until we get to Chapter 8 and look at genes related to serotonin, at which point everything becomes a completely contradictory mess. Just as a hint of what's to come, one gene variant has even been referred to, straight-faced, by some scientists as the warrior gene, and its presence has been used successfully in some courtrooms to lessen sentences for impulsive murders. Conclusions. This completes our introduction to the nervous system and its role in pro- and anti-social behaviors. It was organized around three themes: the hub of fear, aggression, and arousal centered in the amygdala, the hub of reward, anticipation, and motivation of the dopaminergic system, and the hub of frontal cortical regulation and restraint of behavior. Additional brain regions and neurotransmitters will be introduced in subsequent chapters. Amid this mountain of information, be assured that the key brain regions, circuits, and neurotransmitters will become familiar as the book progresses. Hang on. So what does this all mean? It's useful to start with three things that this information doesn't mean. One. First, there's the lure of needing neurobiology to confirm the obvious. Someone claims that, for example, their crappy, violent neighborhood leaves them so anxious that they can't function effectively. Toss them in a brain scanner and flash pictures of various neighborhoods. When their own appears, the amygdala explodes into activity. Ah, it is tempting to conclude, we've now proven that the person really does feel frightened. It shouldn't require neuroscience to validate someone's internal state. An example of this fallacy was reports of atrophy of the hippocampus in combat vets suffering from PTSD. This was in accord with basic research, including from my lab, showing that stress can damage the hippocampus. The hippocampal atrophy in PTSD got a lot of play in Washington, helping to convince skeptics that PTSD is an organic disorder rather than neurotic malingering. It struck me that if it took brain scans to convince legislators that there's something tragically, organically damaged in combat vets with PTSD, then these legislators have some neurological problems of their own. Yet it required precisely this to prove to many that PTSD was an organic brain disorder. The notion that if a neuroscientist can demonstrate it, we know that the person's problem is for real has a corollary. The fancier the neurobiology utilized, the more reliable the verification. That's simply not true. For example, a good neuropsychologist can discern more of what's happening to someone with subtle but pervasive memory problems than can a gazillion-dollar brain scanner. It shouldn't take neuroscience to prove what we think and feel. Two, there's been a proliferation of neuro fields. Some, like neuroendocrinology and neuroimmunology, are stodgy old institutions by now. Others are relatively new. Neuroeconomics, neuromarketing, neuroethics, and, I kid you not, neuroliterature and neuroexistentialism. In other words, a hegemonic neuroscientist might conclude that their field explains everything. And with that comes the danger, raised by the New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik under the sardonic banner of neuroskepticism, that explaining everything leads to forgiving everything. This premise is at the heart of debates in the new field of neurolaw. In Chapter 16, I will argue that it is wrong to think that understanding must lead to forgiveness, mainly because I think that a term like forgiveness and others related to criminal justice, e.g. evil, soul, volition, and blame, are incompatible with science and should be discarded. 3. Finally, there is the danger of thinking that neuroscience supports a tacit sort of dualism. A guy does something impulsive and awful, and neuroimaging reveals that, unexpectedly, he's missing all his PFC neurons. There's a dualist temptation now to view his behavior as more biological or organic in some nebulous manner than if he had committed the same act with a normal PFC. However, the guy's awful, impulsive act is equally biological with or without a PFC. The sole difference is that the workings of the PFC-less brain are easier to understand with our primitive research tools. So what does all of this tell us? Sometimes these studies tell us what different brain regions do. They are getting fancier, telling us about circuits, thanks to the growing time resolution of neuroimaging, transitioning from this stimulus activates brain regions A, B, C to this stimulus activates both A and B and then C, and C activates only if B does. And identifying what specific regions slash circuits do gets harder as studies become subtler. Consider, for example, the fusiform face area. As discussed in the next chapter, it is a cortical region that responds to faces in humans and other primates. We primates sure are social creatures. But work by Isabelle Gauthier of Vanderbilt University demonstrates something more complicated. Show pictures of different cars, and the fusiform activates in automobile aficionados. Show pictures of birds, and ditto among birdwatchers. The fusiform isn't about faces. It's about recognizing examples of things from categories that are emotionally salient to each individual. Thus, studying behavior is useful for understanding the nature of the brain. Ah, isn't it interesting that behavior A arises from the coupling of brain regions X and Y? And sometimes, studying the brain is useful for understanding the nature of behavior. Ah, isn't it interesting that brain region A is central to both behavior X and behavior Y? For example, to me, the most interesting thing about the amygdala is its dual involvement in both aggression and fear. You can't understand the former without recognizing the relevance of the latter. A final point related to the core of this book. While this neurobiology is mighty impressive, the brain is not where a behavior begins. It's merely the final common pathway by which all the factors in the chapters to come converge and create behavior. Chapter 3. Seconds to minutes before. Nothing comes from nothing. No brain is an island. Thanks to messages bouncing around your brain, a command has been sent to your muscles to pull that trigger or touch that arm. Odds are that a short time earlier, something outside your brain prompted this to happen, raising this chapter's key questions. A. What outside stimulus, acting through what sensory channel, and targeting which parts of the brain, prompted this? B. Were you aware of that environmental stimulus? C. What stimuli had your brain made you particularly sensitive to? And of course, D. What does this tell us about our best and worst behaviors? Varied sensory information can prompt the brain into action. This can be appreciated by considering this variety in other species. Often we're clueless about this because animals can sense things in ranges that we can't, or with sensory modalities we didn't know exist. Thus, you must think like the animal to learn what is happening. We'll begin by seeing how this pertains to the field of ethology, the science of interviewing an animal in its own language. Universal rules versus knobby knees. Ethology formed in Europe in the early 20th century in response to an American brand of psychology, behaviorism. Behaviorism descended from the introduction's John Watson. The field's famed champion was B.F. Skinner. Behaviorists cared about universalities of behavior across species. They worshipped a doozy of a seeming universal concerning stimulus and response. Rewarding an organism for a behavior makes the organism more likely to repeat that behavior, while failure to get rewarded, or worse, punishment for it, makes the organism less likely to repeat it. Any behavior can be made more or less common through operant conditioning, a term Skinner coined, the process of controlling the rewards and punishments in the organism's environment. Thus, for behaviorists, or Skinnerians, a term Skinner labored to make synonymous, virtually any behavior could be shaped into greater or lesser frequency or even extinguished entirely. If all behaving organisms obeyed these universal rules, you might as well study a convenient species. Most behaviorist research was done on rats, or Skinner's favorite, pigeons. Behaviorists loved data. No nonsense, hard numbers. These were generated by animals pressing or pecking away at levers in operant conditioning boxes, aka Skinner boxes. And anything discovered applied to any species. A pigeon is a rat, is a boy, Skinner preached. Soulless droid. Behaviorists were often right about behavior, but wrong in really important ways, as many interesting behaviors don't follow behaviorist rules. Raise an infant rat or monkey with an abusive mother, and it becomes more attached to her. And behaviorist rules have failed when humans love the wrong abusive person. Meanwhile, ethology was emerging in Europe, in contrast with behaviorism's obsession with uniformity and universality of behavior. Ethologists loved behavioral variety. They'd emphasize how every species evolves unique behaviors in response to unique demands, and how one had to open-mindedly observe animals in their natural habitats to understand them. Studying rat social behavior in a cage is like studying dolphin swimming behavior in a bathtub, is an ethology adage. They'd ask, what objectively is the behavior? What triggered it? Did it have to be learned? How did it evolve? What is the behavior's adaptive value? 19th century parsons went into nature to collect butterflies, revel in the variety of wing colors, and marvel at what God had wrought. 20th century ethologists went into nature to collect behavior, revel in its variety, and marvel at what evolution had wrought. In contrast to lab coat-clad behaviorists, ethologists tromped around fields in hiking shoes and had fetching, knobby knees. Sensory triggers of behavior in some other species. Using an ethological framework, we now consider sensory triggers of behavior in animals. First, there's the auditory channel. Animals vocalize to intimidate, proclaim, and seduce. Birds sing, stags roar, howler monkeys howl, orangutans give territorial calls audible for miles. As a subtle example of information being communicated, when female pandas ovulate, their vocalizations get higher, something preferred by males. Remarkably, the same shift and preference happens in humans. There are also visual triggers of behavior. Dogs crouch to invite play, birds strut their plumage, monkeys display their canines menacingly with threat yawns. And there are visual cues of cute babiness. Big eyes, shortened muzzle, round forehead that drive mammals crazy, motivating them to care for the kid. Stephen Jay Gould noted that the unsung ethologist Walt Disney understood exactly what alterations transformed rodents into Mickey and Minnie. Then there are animals signaling in ways we can't detect, requiring creativity to interview an animal in its own language. Scads of mammals scent mark with pheromones, odors that carry information about sex, age, reproductive status, health, and genetic makeup. Some snakes see in infrared. Electric eels court with electric songs. Bats compete by jamming one another's feeding echolocation signals, and spiders identify intruders by vibration patterns on their webs. How about this? Tickle a rat, and it chirps ultrasonically as its mesolimbic dopamine system is activated. Back to the rhinencephalon / limbic system war, and the resolution ethologists already knew. For a rodent, emotion is typically triggered by olfaction. Across species, the dominant sensory modality, vision, sounds, whichever, has the most direct access to the limbic system. Under the radar, subliminal and unconscious cueing. It's easy to see how the sight of a knife, the sound of a voice calling your name, a touch on your hand can rapidly alter your brain. But crucially, tons of subliminal sensory triggers occur, so fleeting or minimal that we don't consciously note them, or of a type that, even if noted, seems irrelevant to a subsequent behavior. Subliminal cueing and unconscious priming influence numerous behaviors unrelated to this book. People think potato chips taste better when hearing crunching sounds. We like a neutral stimulus more if, just before seeing it, a picture of a smiling face is flashed for a 20th of a second. The more expensive a supposed placebo painkiller, the more effective people report the placebo to be. Ask subjects their favorite detergent. If they've just read a paragraph containing the word ocean, they're more likely to choose Tide, and then explain its cleaning virtues. Thus, over the course of seconds, sensory cues can shape your behavior unconsciously. A hugely unsettling sensory cue concerns race. Our brains are incredibly attuned to skin color. Flash a face for less than a tenth of a second, 100 milliseconds, so short a time that people aren't even sure they've seen something. Have them guess the race of the pictured face, and there's a better than even chance of accuracy. We may claim to judge someone by the content of their character rather than by the color of their skin, but our brains sure as hell note the color real fast. By 100 milliseconds, brain function already differs in two depressing ways, depending on the race of the face, as shown with neuroimaging. First, in a widely replicated finding, the amygdala activates. Moreover, the more racist someone is in an implicit test of race bias, stay tuned, the more activation there is. Similarly, repeatedly show subjects a picture of a face accompanied by a shock, soon, seeing the face alone activates the amygdala. As shown by Elizabeth Phelps of NYU, such fear conditioning occurs faster for other race than same race faces. Amygdalae are prepared to learn to associate something bad with them. Moreover, people judge neutral other race faces as angrier than neutral same race faces. So if whites see a black face shown at subliminal speed, the amygdala activates. But if the face is shown long enough for conscious processing, the anterior cingulate and the cognitive DLPFC then activate and inhibit the amygdala. It's the frontal cortex exerting executive control over the deeper, darker amygdaloid response. Second depressing finding. Subliminal signaling of race also affects the fusiform face area, the cortical region that specializes in facial recognition. Damaging the fusiform, for example, selectively produces face blindness, aka prosopagnosia, an inability to recognize faces. Work by John Gabrielli at MIT demonstrates less fusiform activation for other race faces, with the effect strongest in the most implicitly racist subjects. This isn't about novelty. Show a face with purple skin, and the fusiform responds as if it's same race. The fusiform isn't fooled. That's not an other, it's just a normal, photoshopped face. In accord with that, white Americans remember white better than black faces. Moreover, mixed-race faces are remembered better if described as being of a white rather than a black person. Remarkably, if mixed-race subjects are told they've been assigned to one of the two races for the study, they show less fusiform response to faces of the arbitrarily designated other race. Our attunement to race is shown in another way, too. Show a video of someone's hand being poked with a needle, and subjects have an isomorphic sensory motor response, hands tense in empathy. Among both whites and blacks, the response is blunted for other race hands. The more the implicit racism, the more blunting. Similarly, among subjects of both races, there's more activation of the emotional, medial PFC when considering misfortune befalling a member of their own race than of another race. This has major implications. In work by Joshua Correll at the University of Colorado, subjects were rapidly shown pictures of people holding either a gun or a cell phone and were told to shoot only gun toters. This is painfully reminiscent of the 1999 killing of Amadou Diallo. Diallo, a West African immigrant in New York, matched a description of a rapist. Four white officers questioned him, and when the unarmed Diallo started to pull out his wallet, they decided it was a gun and fired 41 shots. The underlying neurobiology concerns event-related potentials, ERPs, which are stimulus-induced changes in electrical activity of the brain, as assessed by EEG, electroencephalography. Threatening faces produce a distinctive change, called the P200 component, in the ERP waveform in under 200 milliseconds. Among white subjects, viewing someone black evokes a stronger P200 waveform than viewing someone white, regardless of whether the person is armed. Then, a few milliseconds later, a second inhibitory waveform, the N200 component, appears, originating from the frontal cortex. Let's think a sec about what we're seeing before we shoot. Viewing a black individual evokes less of an N200 waveform than does seeing someone white. The greater the P200/N200 ratio, i.e., the greater the ratio of I'm feeling threatened to hold on a sec, the greater the likelihood of shooting an unarmed black individual. In another study, subjects had to identify fragmented pictures of objects. Priming white subjects with subliminal views of black, but not white, faces made them better at detecting pictures of weapons, but not cameras or books. Finally, for the same criminal conviction, the more stereotypically African a black individual's facial features, the longer the sentence. In contrast, juries view black, but not white, male defendants more favorably if they're wearing big, clunky glasses. Some defense attorneys even exploit this nerd defense by accessorizing their clients with fake glasses, and prosecuting attorneys ask whether those dorky glasses are real. In other words, when blind, impartial justice is supposedly being administered, jurors are unconsciously biased by racial stereotypes of someone's face. This is so depressing. Are we hardwired to fear the face of someone of another race, to process their face less as a face, to feel less empathy? No. For starters, there's tremendous individual variation. Not everyone's amygdala activates in response to an other race face, and those exceptions are informative. Moreover, subtle manipulations rapidly change the amygdaloid response to the face of an other. This will be covered in Chapter 11. Recall the shortcut to the amygdala discussed in the previous chapter, when sensory information enters the brain. Most is funneled through that sensory way station in the thalamus and then to the appropriate cortical region, e.g., the visual or auditory cortex, for the slow, arduous process of decoding light pixels, sound waves, and so on into something identifiable. And finally, information about it, it's Mozart, is passed to the limbic system. As we saw, there's that shortcut from the thalamus directly to the amygdala, such that while the first few layers of, say, the visual cortex are futzing around with unpacking a complex image, the amygdala is already thinking, "That's a gun," and reacting. And as we saw, there's the trade-off. Information reaches the amygdala fast, but is often inaccurate. The amygdala thinks it knows what it's seeing before the frontal cortex slams on the brakes. An innocent man reaches for his wallet and dies. Other types of subliminal visual information influence the brain. For example, the gender of a face is processed within 150 milliseconds, ditto with social status. Social dominance looks the same across cultures. Direct gaze, open posture, e.g. leaning back with arms behind the head, while subordination is signaled with averted gaze, arms sheltering the torso. After a mere 40 millisecond exposure, subjects accurately distinguish high from low status presentations. As we'll see in Chapter 12, when people are figuring out stable status relations, logical areas of the frontal cortex, the VMPFC and DLPFC, activate. But in the case of unstable, flip-flopping relations, the amygdala also activates. It's unsettling when we're unsure who gets ulcers and who gives them. There's also subliminal cueing about beauty. From an early age, in both sexes and across cultures, attractive people are judged to be smarter, kinder, and more honest. We're more likely to vote for attractive people or hire them, less likely to convict them of crimes, and, if they are convicted, more likely to dole out shorter sentences. Remarkably, the medial orbitofrontal cortex assesses both the beauty of a face and the goodness of a behavior, and its level of activity during one of those tasks predicts the level during the other. The brain does similar things when contemplating beautiful minds, hearts, and cheekbones, and assumes that cheekbones tell something about minds and hearts. This will be covered in Chapter 12. Though we derive subliminal information from bodily cues, such as posture, we get the most information from faces. Why else evolve the fusiform? The shape of women's faces changes subtly during their ovulatory cycle, and men prefer female faces at the time of ovulation. Subjects guess political affiliation or religion at above-chance levels just by looking at faces. And for the same transgression, people who look embarrassed, blushing, eyes averted, face angled downward and to the side, are more readily forgiven. Eyes give the most information. Take pictures of two faces with different emotions and switch different facial parts between the two with cutting and pasting. What emotion is detected? The one in the eyes. Eyes often have an implicit censorious power. Post a large picture of a pair of eyes at a bus stop versus a picture of flowers, and people become more likely to clean up litter. Post a picture of eyes in a workplace coffee room, and the money paid on the honor system triples. Show a pair of eyes on a computer screen, and people become more generous in online economic games. Subliminal auditory cues also alter behavior. Back to amygdaloid activation in whites subliminally viewing black faces. Chad Forbes of the University of Delaware shows that the amygdala activation increases if loud rap music, a genre typically associated more with African Americans than with whites, plays in the background. The opposite occurs when evoking